Hello, I'm Dan Yergin, Vice Chairman of IHS Market, and I want to welcome you to CERAWeek Conversations presented by IHS Market. I'm very pleased to be able to be joined today by Bernard Looney, who's the Chief Executive of BP. We have a lot to talk about, and Bernard, welcome.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks very much for having me. And it's I see your book, The Prize, in the background, and as I was growing up in the oil industry, your book was the one to read, and I never thought I'd be sitting here with you today. So thank you very much for having me on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think you became chief executive CEO in the middle of February, and you had a 100-day plan, as one often does at a time of transition. And then about 30 days into that 100 days, the world changed. And you sort of had to improvise a plan going forward. How did you go about doing it?
Well, I'm glad I didn't put so much time into that 100-day plan because, as you say, it went out the window very quickly. And it's been an extraordinary few months. But it's been an extraordinary few months for the world, Dan, hasn't it? And I think as difficult as we all feel that we have it, there are a lot of people in this world who are having it more difficult than us. People have lost loved ones, people that are on the front line that, you know, that are protecting us in the health sector and police and so on and so forth. And so I think in many ways we have the privilege of working from home, someone once said, because many, many people don't, and indeed many people inside BP. People who are working in our retail stations, who are providing fuel and food, people who are working in our facilities offshore and refineries, providing a little bit of the energy and the fuel that the world needs. So it's been an incredible time, and we've tried to anchor, Dan, very quickly on three things that we felt were really important, and it's been helpful. Number one was we wanted to protect the health of our people, a very obvious thing that we should want to do. And then secondly, we wanted to support our communities where we work. And then thirdly, we want to strengthen our finances. So those are the three things that became very quickly, very clear, and they've sort of been our guiding light posts, so to speak, as we've gone through it. But enormously grateful to all of our people and for everything that they're doing.
Many people can work from home. Many things cannot be done from home. What have been the challenges with the people in the field on the platforms, from the platforms to the service stations?
It's been extraordinary. And it's been one of the privileges of my job, actually, is getting to know the variety of people that we have inside the company. And retail workers are one that I probably didn't have a lot of exposure to in the past in my old role. And for example, here in the UK, we have 6,000 retail staff. They are working right on the front line. They are providing critical services to people. They're wearing full PPE because they're exposed to the virus every day because of their job. And, you know, in some cases, exposed to the public, and it's a stressful time for the public, and you can imagine how that translates over. So these are people who are not enormously well paid. And in fact, we've just made a decision here in the UK to pay what's called a real living wage, because we felt that this is what these folks deserve. And it really was amplified by what we've seen because of COVID. So that's one example. But then we have people with 13,000 people in the middle of Papua, something like a 12-hour journey from Jakarta, building an LNG train. And while we had medical facilities for an accident, we didn't have medical facilities for a pandemic. And we took the decision to downman that facility. We got down to about 5,000 people, but we could only get 350 people a day out because of how remote it is. And then we have people all around the world, Dan, who are doing extended shifts. I was speaking to a team offshore in Angola last week, and there was a woman offshore there who hadn't seen her young baby in almost, I think it was 12 weeks, because they were working extended shifts. And then when they came back, they were in quarantine and so on and so forth. So people have been going, I think, to extraordinary lengths. And I'm sure it's true in every company, but it's certainly true inside BP.
And in terms of, you know, connectivity, in terms of pivoting, in terms of how you organize your time. How often do you meet with your team daily, weekly? How do you handle all the connections across the company?
Well, it's been an amazing time because, of course, not alone am I new in my job, but we have a new team that's just been announced on the 12th of February. And there are 12 of us, and we're basically all new to our roles in one form or another. I'm very proud of them. We've got a third of them are women. We've got an Indian. We've got someone who speaks Mandarin. It's a very diverse team. And we're coming together virtually because we're not able to have those getaways and get-togethers that you would have when you bring a team together. And not alone that, Dan, but this is a group of people that are designing a new organization, which we'll talk about, selecting their leadership teams. And we've just announced the what we call the next level tier two leadership, where we've gone from 240 leaders down to 120. So a halving of the size of the leadership at the top. And thankfully, we've got 40% women in there, almost a third ethnic diversity. So they're selecting new people. They're developing their strategies because some of their strategies will be new, all while dealing with negative oil prices, a pandemic, and trying to do it all virtually. And so I, as you can tell, I'm really proud of my team. And I think it's an extraordinary confluence of events that has come together, but it is what we do and it is what we get on and do. So
I guess the technology allows you to come together quickly and often without a lot of friction of airplane flights.
It does. The technology, I think we've all found, Dan, haven't we, that the technology is actually incredible. And, you know, as you say, how often do we meet? We meet at least twice a week. And we've become quite regimented on how we meet. We meet for no longer than 45 minutes without a break. We always make sure that people get a proper break for lunch because people are trying, they have families at home and they have children to look after and so on and so forth. So it really does require some discipline, but I find that discipline is actually really helpful because our meetings are, I would argue, much more efficient because we have these very simple rules of no longer than 45 minutes, we got to get through an agenda. So
I guess that people don't go on. They get the
maybe I'm the worst offender. I'm Irish, so I'll talk forever. But they're good enough to give me feedback. But it is good. And I've been surprised, actually, at how effective it's been. And, of course, we're all thinking about or were thinking about when we get back to the office. But I think in many ways we realize that whole new world is actually going to be quite different. And we're all thinking about what that new normal looks like.
Right. I guess any glimmers yet?
Well, I think what I know, and people ask us this a lot, Dan, what I know is that it's going to be different. I mean, that's the only thing, and it doesn't sound like much, but I think it is an important statement. The fact that our work will get done by people turning up at an office working in the West Monday to Friday, and that's how we work, I think that has changed. Now, what the new looks like, I think we have yet to really formalize and get clear on. But there is no question in my mind that this has brought about a level of flexibility and a desire for flexibility that I think will absolutely be core to the future. So this morning I got up, I went and had my run, I had my breakfast, and I was thinking I would normally go to work. But actually, in a morning like today, it might have been good for me to spend the morning at home, catch up on email, make a couple of calls, and maybe go to the office in the afternoon to meet with people and to collaborate on a problem. So it's going to be different. It is not going to be going back to normal. And I don't think in many aspects of life, when we see what's happening in the United States today and indeed around the world, we shouldn't want to go back to normal. We should be embracing this concept of people are talking about building back better, but they say we should build forward, actually. And how do we create a greener, fairer, smarter society? So I'm quite optimistic about the future.
Well, in terms of building forward, if we go back to February 12th, you announced two big things. One is net zero carbon, and two, reinventing BP. So I'd like to, you know, we're now in June, parse I'd like to parse both of those now. How did your thinking evolve on net zero carbon? Was it something you'd been thinking about for years, or did you start thinking about it in September? What influenced you to decide that that's the destination?
Well, obviously, you know Bob, and you know Bob well, laid a great groundwork here, Dan, and my role was to come on and take that to the next level. And I have been thinking about this for a long time, and I went out after I was announced, I think, in early October, and I've been going around and listening. And my mother used to tell me that, you know, we have two ears and one mouth, and we should use them in that proportion. And I think it's very good advice. So I went on the road and I met with investors. I met with members of society. I met with NGOs. I met with academics. I met with the United Nations. I met with activists. And of course, I listened to our own staff. And it became clear to me that this is what all those constituents at some level wanted. And in many ways, we say, how do you make trade-offs between what society want and what shareholders want? Actually, I believe that there is much more of a confluence of what they want. Investors, of course, want a financial return, but they also want to invest in companies that are having a positive impact on our world. So that's what we've been doing. We were listening. We were being challenged. I always say to people, listen to understand, don't listen to respond. And so I think we did a lot of understanding. And there's a lot of good people out there, Dan, that want to do the right thing for the world. Well, they have different views.
I've seen you mention that one conversation you had with a former BP person had a big...
Yes, and that was at our annual general meeting last year, and we had a young woman who had left BP, Jo Alexander is her name, and she left BP because at some stage she felt that her internal purpose and the purpose of the company were not aligned. And you know, it really struck me because we like many of the other companies that you deal with, we're a good company and we're made up of good people. And of course, it hurts when you hear that. And I listened to her and I shared with her some of the things that we were going to do, including our ambition to get to net zero by 2050 or sooner, and indeed to help the world get there. And I'm glad to say she's an employee of the company today. So she's back working for BP and she's helping us in a number of areas. I'm really proud of her. And I hope, I feel a responsibility, Dan, to live up to her expectations now.
Bernard, I know you're going to roll out in September what the plan is, but what are the three or four big building blocks of that you see to get there?
Well, we came out with 10 aims, and there were five to help the company get to net zero and five to help the world get to net zero. And in terms of us getting to net zero, aim one is about our scope 1 and 2 emissions, which I think everybody is working on. And we have things that are ongoing inside the company to improve that around efficiency and power usage and leaks and so on and so forth. The second aim was a really important one, Dan, and it said that if we look at the carbon content, this is really scope 3, if we look at the carbon content of the oil and gas that we, as BP, are uniquely responsible for introducing into the world, we have an ambition to take that to net zero, which is an incredible thing for what is predominantly an oil and gas company to say. And we will get there through our portfolio. So we will produce less oil and gas over time. I think that was a big statement that we made on February the 12th.
It was a big statement.
It took a little bit of courage to get over the line on that. But actually, I believe it's the right thing. We're not about volume. We're about value. We're about cash flow. And I believe that we can satisfy our carbon expectations and satisfy our investors' expectations around value better this way. And at some stage, we will have, towards the back end, some natural climate solutions and carbon capture and storage. So, but it'll be predominantly be delivered by volume. And then aim 3 is about the intensity of our products and how we reduce that. And then aim 4, Dan, was around methane. And I think it's a great example, if I may, Dan, that it's a great example of listening and engaging and having dialogue. Because I said to our team, we have a methane intensity target of 0.2%, less than 0.2%. And I said to our team, we're going to do this thing on the 12th of February. Let's have it. You know, let's cut it in half and see if we can do even better. And they said, Bernard, go and talk to some of the NGOs in this space. And when I did and I listened, they said, Bernard, we're not sure we believe your numbers because they're estimates. What we really want you to do is to measure your methane leakage and then develop an improvement plan. So that's what we've said. We have said that we will measure our methane at all of our existing facilities worldwide by 2023. And once we have that measured basis, we will then set a target to have it. And that's the type of dialogue that makes a difference.
Unlike, I think, many people who are in senior positions in the energy industry, I believe you're an electrical engineer, not a petroleum engineer.
This is true, but not a very good one, Dan, I have to add.
But now, as you look forward to the new businesses, what are the new businesses? They do carry you more in one way or another, more into electricity. And I'm just thinking, what are the actual businesses that you see? I mean, it's charging is one you're in.
Yeah. Well, I think, and we'll come back, obviously, with this in September when we have our Capital Markets Day. But without question, low-carbon electricity will be a big part of that. We already own 50% of Europe's largest solar developer. We're in 13 countries around the world now. Unquestionably, wind will be part of that, and we'll be talking about what we're doing in that space. Bioenergy, Dan, is an area that I think has great potential. And then, as you said, electrification of mobility and mobility services, I think you will see us talk a lot about. Today, we have a partnership with Didi in China. Didi owns 20% of China's electric vehicles. 20%, one company owning 20% of China's EVs. I think they have 30 million rides a day and almost 500 million customers. We're their charging partner. We're going to help them build their fleet charging network in China. And it's a great story about how a company that people would say, what relevant skills do you have? But actually, we own the largest charging provider in the United Kingdom. It's called ChargeMaster. We have great experience of building out retail networks across the world in all sorts of places, India, Mexico, and so on. But what's really interesting, Dan, is when you ask Didi today, what is it that you've most liked about working with BP? They say it's their operating management system. It's their commitment to safety, and what we didn't have a system for our drivers. Now, that's something that we, not that we take it for granted, but it's very natural to a company like ours to have an operating management system. And yet, if you're a company like Didi, you look at that and you say, can I have that, please? Can we share that? It's very, very interesting.
Well, that's a very interesting point you make because, of course, what does a company like BP bring to the energy transition? And A, and B, can you do an energy transition without companies like BP?
Well, you know, look, I'm sure there's a lot of people that would prefer if you couldn't. And I understand that point. I obviously don't agree with it. Well, here's how I like to think about it. I think about it twofold, Dan. Number one, we've got about 6,000 engineers in our company. We've got 2,500 scientists. We're one of the world's largest trading organizations. We build very big projects. We operate very large plants. We're truly global. We're in 78 countries. And that is not in any way to boast about what we are, because we're not perfect and we make mistakes and we don't always get things right. But it is a skill set that has been built up over 110 years. And therefore, I do believe that we have something to add. And I think the real thing that we have to add, Dan, is what we would like to think, what we talk a lot about is integration. If you take a Microsoft or an Amazon and their big data centers and they want power for those, what do they want? They want a power that is clean, it's reliable, and it's cheap, okay? Now, it's very hard for them to go to a solar company or a wind company and get that, because while they might get clean and cheap, they may not get reliable. And they don't want to have to deal with several different companies. And that's where we come along. A company like ours that might be in wind and solar, will obviously be in gas. We'll have a trading entity that can manage the shorts and the longs and balance them, the market, so that they can get that reliability, maybe on a digital platform. That's a unique offering. It's very easy to do solar when it's 10% of the grid. When it gets to 60 or 70%, the intermittency becomes an issue. We need different forms of energy. We need to integrate those solutions. And that's where I think a company like ours comes in.
Right, and why it's part of the transition. But I notice when people, you know, they interview you about what you're talking about, many journalists then feel they always need to bring in an activist who says, well, we don't really believe them. Does that ever frustrate you?
Well, you know, look, of course, it's frustrating at times because you think you knew yourself, your own commitment to what you're trying to do. But having said it's frustrating, I also understand it. And I think it's very important, Dan, in life in general, and it's advice to myself, not advice to anyone else, but it's always important to do two things. One, put yourself in the other person's shoes. You know, think about it from their perspective. Why might they not have trust in us? And I can imagine some reasons why they might not have trust in us. And secondly, before we blame them and say that they just don't understand, I think we do need to hold up a mirror and look at ourselves. So, of course, it's frustrating because I think we believe that we deeply believe in this. But equally, I have empathy for people's position. And I think a lot of people are good people. And if they have a belief about us, then I think we need to look at ourselves every bit as much as we need to look at them.
Well, let me then go to the other big thing that you announced on February 12th, which you mentioned the prize. And of course, I remember when I was writing the prize, I had to write a whole section about upstream and downstream, you know, because it's so immutable. Right. And you, until this job, you were running the upstream. And what you talk about reinventing BP, there's no upstream, downstream anymore. It's four different businesses. Can you explain what those businesses are and the logic?
Well, very good. And there is no more upstream and downstream. What we had was two very large segments, and they were colossal segments inside the company. And they sort of dominated, Dan. You're either an upstreamer or you're a downstreamer. And at some stage, we felt that actually what we don't want is two big segments. We want one segment, and that one segment is called BP. And that's what we've tried to do, is bring it together in one. Now, of course, we have organizational units. So what did we focus on? The first thing we said is we really want to make sure that the operations of the company are run well, safely and reliably. And we have decided to put all of the operations of BP in one place. Some companies have all the projects of the company in one place. We've chosen to put all the operations of the company in one place. The second thing was obviously a focus on customers. We talk a lot about governments, but actually I think customers and what we can do for customers in the future, particularly in the world of electrification and mobility, I think is huge. So we created an entity around that. Then we have low carbon, and we felt that it was important to bring gas and low carbon together, but we wanted to focus on low carbon electricity and energy. And then finally, innovation. And I think innovation is absolutely at the core of a company being able to reinvent itself. And we've done that. So we have tried to create, and are trying to create, a lighter, more agile, more focused, and quite frankly, more integrated company. And I'm quite excited about it.
So new organization, but you're still very much in a very big way in the oil and gas business. So we can take a little bit of time and actually talk about that. You know, we've seen prices go from $63 at the beginning of the year to minus 37 for a few minutes. And now, you know, really quite reversed. How's the business doing?
Well, it's tough. And it's, I've said it publicly, it's a brutal environment that we face at the moment. It has recovered a little bit over the recent weeks. But as I would remind our own organization, you know, it's a recovery from a very low point. And while we may have a recovery in crude prices, I think gas prices are still quite depressed. And refining margins are still very depressed. And the crude market is recovering far ahead of the product market. So it is a brutal environment, and therefore we act. We can't predict the price of oil. You would definitely tell me that, and I think we've all learned that over time. And we don't control it, and therefore we concentrate on what we control. So we've taken our capital down. We're taking costs out of the system. We're going to take about $2.5 billion out by the end of next year. I hope we will do more, actually, in that space. And we're going to get what we call our balance point down to around $35 a barrel next year. So that's what we're trying to do.
I wanted to ask you, what is balance point? I didn't know that phrase.
Well, balance point is basically, and we used to call it break even, but balance point is the language that we want to use then, because it's not just the oil price that you break even in, but what's your gas price assumption and what's your refining margin assumption. And with some reduced assumptions on both gas and refining to reflect a more difficult environment, we think we can balance the books next year at around $35. That means that we can invest about $12 billion into the business to do the things that we need to do. We can pay a dividend, and we can do that at $35, which is a pretty healthy oil price to do that. But we're not there today, and we're on our way there.
Well, the balance point, in other words, is not the break even of particular production somewhere. It's a number for the whole company.
It's a number for the whole company. In fact, if you tuck away the dividend, you'll find that we can get that number down to less than $10 a barrel. So the business can get in good shape quite quickly because it's been running well and it's been performing well, and we know what we need to do. But it is a tough environment, and tough decisions have to be made, and we're in the midst of doing that.
So having run the upstream, what have you seen in terms of just innovations there? I know you've put effort into standardization and other things, but, you know, in terms of making the upstream be more efficient in.
Well, I think a lot has happened, as have many companies, and I admire a lot of what our competitors have done as well over the years. But we have really taken costs out of the system. I remember, Dan, in 2016, we said that we would bring on 1 million barrels a day of production by 2021. That was about 35 major projects. And I think we thought at the time it would cost us about $50 billion. We're going to do it for between $35 and $40 billion. We used to have 30,000 people in the upstream. Today, we have about 17,000. So we're doing it with a lot less people. And go ahead.
No, I was going to say, did the experience of you stepped into this part of your broader upstream job in 2016, did that prepare you in a way for where we are now?
I think the upstream has always had a lot to learn from the downstream in our traditional world. And the downstream is a margin business, and it's a highly competitive business. And I have long admired the rigor and the discipline and the innovation that they bring to their business. And I think the upstream, as an oil and gas business, can benefit from that. And that's what we've been trying to do over the past several years. But there are so many things that I'll give you one example, and this is enabled by digital, but what we call centralization and putting skills in one place. A couple of years ago, we drilled a well in West Africa. It cost $150 million. We had about 45 expats in country. It's our traditional business model. Just recently, we drilled the same well. We basically one expat in country. We ran it out of London, and the cost of drilling that well was $50 million. So it's extraordinary what can be achieved when we put our minds to it. And I've always been a believer that the numbers are so big in the upstream that there remains enormous opportunity for improvement. We're going to go digital. We absolutely believe in it. We have done, and we're going to take it to the next level. We've done a good job on our back office. We're now bringing it into our operation system. We want to be able to get to a place then where you can raise a work order, order a part, get it delivered, install it, be invoiced for it, pay for it. We want that chain to be touchless. If we can do that, we'll take out 30 to 40% of our cost. These are just some examples of the things that lie ahead. And we're going to go agile. And agile is a term that's used a lot, but we're actually going to structure our oil and gas business in an agile way. Banks have done it. Technology has done it. But we're actually going to bring it in. We piloted it in Azerbaijan. It works great. It is about delayering. So it's taking layers out of the organization. It's very something that we all know very, very well, multidisciplinary teams working together. It's about a singular focus. So a big thing in Agile is we're much better when we work on one problem at a time. And then finally, and I think the most importantly, it turns the job of leadership on its head. All too often, people in organizations look up. They wait to get in the diary to get a decision made. Our diaries are busy, so it might take weeks and weeks to get on our calendar. We're changing that. The job of a leader is to support their organization. The job of a leader is to go to the work site. It may be a facility, but it may also be the second floor of your building. Go once a week, meet with the team. They tell you what problems they have. You sort their problems. You make decisions right there and then. It's changing the clock speed of decision-making inside our company by between 60 and 70%. It is extraordinary.
Let me just ask you a couple more questions about the oil and gas business. The role of shale in your portfolio, how you see, you know.
Well, shale is an extraordinary resource. We did the BHP transaction in the Lower 48 a couple of years ago. We're really, really pleased with what we got. You look at a few things. You look at the rocks. Are they as good as what we thought? We're delighted with what we've got. We're surprised on the upside, particularly in the Eagle Ford. We like that a lot, but the Permian is very, very good. We then look at the cost to run the business and the synergies then that we think that we could get out. We promised $350 million by 2021. We promised $80 million in the first year. We delivered $270 in year one. We'll accelerate that $350, and we think we'll go beyond $400 million in total synergy savings. And then, of course, what it does offer you, which is what we're seeing right now, is it does offer you that flexibility. And we were planning to put about $2 billion into that business this year, and today we'll put about $1 billion into that business. So we've gone from about 13 rigs to, I think, one rig. And that flexibility is important as we seek to respond to a situation that we find ourselves in.
I mean, there's always a big question about what a shale cost. Is there a number that you think or a range?
Well, people do debate it, don't they? All I will say is that it's going down, and I think it will continue to go down. And I know that people say, well, it sort of began to plateau out. But I am a believer, and Dave Lawler, who runs that business for us, is a massive believer. He believes this is a tech business. He doesn't believe it's as much a reservoir business or a traditional oil and gas business. He definitely believes it's a tech business. Yeah. And the things that we've been able to do with taking people out of harm's way and taking people out of the field and getting costs down and the improvements we can make, I think are exceptional. And I don't think they have stopped. I think there's much more to do.
How does the OPEC Plus decisions where governments decide, you know, we're going to go down by X percent, 23% or something, how are you experiencing it as a company? Is it the same in all the different countries? Is it different? Do you get a letter or do they give you a call?
Well, you know,
We're a guest in countries,
and we're developing the country's resources, and we're a contractor in that regard. And I have to say that the cooperation with governments around the world has been excellent. I also think compliance with the cuts around the world has been very, very strong. So we've experienced it, Dan, in the places that we work, in Angola, in the Middle East, in Iraq, Abu Dhabi. We've experienced it in Azerbaijan and in Russia. So this is something that, you know, we've obviously responded to. As I say, we are there at the request of the country, and the country has decisions that it needs to make. We understand them. And of course, we've completely complied with them, but it's very active.
Have you been, and in terms of where you're in control and it isn't up to the government, have you been shutting in wells and sense of how, when you bring them back?
We've been very fortunate, Dan, because we do have a trading organization, and its number one purpose in life is to ensure what we call flow optimization and making sure that we can get our flow of our products to marketplace. And we've been able to do that. So it is an advantage that we have that probably not every company has had. So we have not had to shut in any of our operated production because we simply couldn't find a home. And I do know that has been the case for some people. So we're very fortunate in that regard.
And shutting in just for economic reasons, of course, the price has come back now.
Yeah, the price has come back. We haven't had to shut in for economic reasons on our operating facilities. Our business is pretty strong. The break-evens, as we alluded earlier, to those individual businesses are good. And we've been able to keep going through this process.
So, Bernard, kind of last question. You mentioned very kindly at the beginning of the prize. For me, one of the Bibles is BP Statistical Review. And I know that's true for many other people in the world. It is, you know, it's like a spine for what you do. So I know some people, when some journalists, they want to get you to say oil is going to peak, has peaked, will peak, some ask you that way. But just your framework for thinking about the future of the market and demand. I mean, just how you approach it.
Look, I think, as you say, a lot of people ask about peak oil, and I've been quoted in the media as saying that it may already have peaked. And of course,
you've also been quoted saying maybe it hasn't peaked.
And maybe it hasn't. Well, that's in the fine print. But the answer is we don't know. I think that's the reality. Look, I think as you look out in the future, is oil demand going to grow at 3%, 4%, 5% per annum for the next 20 or 30 years? No. What is going to happen? Oil demand growth is probably slowing.
And is hydrogen part of that?
Hydrogen is exciting. It's probably something that will come to real life in the next decade, but you can expect to see us play in it in this decade. And I do think hydrogen has a future for sure.
Well, Bernard, thank you very much for joining us today. I think we've covered a range of both the future businesses and the businesses today. We look forward to hearing in September as you really put things in more detailed fashion about what this new future building, but want to wish you the best and indeed express our great appreciation to you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Dan, and thanks for all that you and IHS do. So thank you very much.
Thank you. We've been talking with Bernard Looney, who's the chief executive of BP. And thank you for joining us on this CERAWeek conversation brought to you by IHS Markit.